And welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And this week we actually have a special edition of the show because the later half of the show will feature actually the half of the episode that was specially made for the National Homelessness Marathon, which happened last Thursday. So the 22nd of February was when that took place. And the show is produced by our friend Stephanie out in St. John, New Brunswick, mm-hmm. as a part of her series called Queer, K-W-I-R. Mm-hmm. I love the name. I think it's great. So we'll be lending our ear to that special episode where Stephanie interviews folks who talk about trans homelessness across Canada.
Right.
So really interesting, unique perspective there. So we're looking forward to it. Before we get there, though, mm-hmm. there is some Canadian news and some somewhat entertaining international news that I kind of want to talk about. Are you a Danish? That's all I'm saying for now. More on that later. Anyway, so the story that we're going to kick off with is not that great.
My brain is just going through gluten intolerance jokes right now about, like,
I'm not a Danish.
If you are, I can't eat you. I don't know. Something like that. Don't drink tea when I'm about to make a joke. You're going to... Yes.
Anyway, the story we're talking about this week is not stellar news, and it is more information about... And I hate saying his name because it gives a platform.
Didn't you say that guy?
That guy who committed a series of murders in the gay community in Toronto.
Yeah.
So he who shall not be named.
Okay.
This is a foul man who is now responsible for what Toronto Police Service has called the largest serial killer case, if not the only serial killer case they've ever investigated. It is in... They're covering dozens of locations.
Yeah.
They confirmed the body of Skandaraj Navarantnam, who was a 40-year-old man, and it was one of the bodies that they identified in the planters. So he is now the sixth murder that Bruce MacArthur has been charged with.
Right.
They expect more.
And from what I understand, one of the missing men who originally spurned the community to demand an investigation, they still haven't found him. Which means...
A number of them. I think there was five men missing. They've only charged relating to one or two.
There was three that the community was fully convinced were linked, and then another two that the community suspected was a part of it as well. And they haven't found all of them, but they have found 12 in total, which means all these people that weren't even on the radar of the community. So it's getting very messy that it's turning... Very large, very fast as a case. They thought they were going to be looking for three or four sites, and instead...
Well, they're searching 30 locations, which is huge. But actually, the biggest news that we've discovered, because we on the show shared with our listeners that a couple of weeks ago, the most recent cases, the ones that really raised the profile, were highly sophisticated in terms of how he executed the sort of entrapment of his victims, in terms of how he conducted the actual murder, and more importantly, extremely sophisticated in terms of how he executed getting away with it.
Yeah.
This was not the murder of a noob, of a novice.
Yeah.
This is a man who had honed his skill being literally getting away with murder.
Yes.
So for detectives, that was a bit of a alarm bells ringing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what they're now doing, they're looking as far back as the 80s, and they're tracking his movements across Canada. Unfortunately, this man was a traveling salesman. So now they have to phone up, you know, small police services around Ontario and the rest of Canada and be like, can you go digging through your paper files
from
the
cases?
80s
yeah.
to see if there's any missing cases? They're also looking at unsolved murders and unsolved deaths. So deaths that weren't considered murders, but maybe match the pattern of his
John Doe's as well. Bodies that have turned up with...
They're looking at something like 200 missing people cases to cross-reference and see if they match his patterns of movement over the past 10, 15 years. But they're going back decades, mm-hmm. and it's now unfolding into what is one of the largest police investigations in Canadian history,
yeah.
in terms of finding the scope of this man's depravity. So it's truly shocking, truly, truly shocking. This is a man who is highly skilled at what is the most heinous crime. So that's the wonderful news that we have to bring to the table.
But on the other hand, answers.
This is true.
For friends and family who never learned what happened to their missing loved ones. So, I mean, it's even when answers are horrible, depending on who you are, I mean, different people have different, you know, emotional reactions to this kind of thing. But it is a pretty common narrative from people who find out that their child or their parent or their brother was taken away by someone, and they can actually identify what happened. That there are people who are like, well, knowing what happened and knowing that there's a resolution is better than not knowing what happened. So
a lot of the criticism of how the police investigated these missing persons files is that they never linked them all together.
Yeah.
And the police actually admitted, I think it was to the National Post, that because Andrew Kinsman was reported missing within 3 days,
yeah.
I think he was out for Pride and he just disappeared. And mm-hmm. everyone's like, you know, you dude, I had brunch. You didn't show up at brunch.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really strange. And then his family checked the apartment and no one had fed the cat. And it was like, this is very out of character.
Yeah, yeah.
For a man who was extremely responsible. He was the superintendent in his building and he hadn't put the trash out. And he never does that.
Yeah.
So for them, it was that really quick reporting time. The police said, had he been reported a couple of days later, they still may never have caught Bruce MacArthur. So it was the quick response from his family.
The process of linking cases to see if there is a pattern is now automated. So I don't know if you knew that, but they've introduced filing systems for missing persons. And it was implemented over the past few years, but fully implemented across Canada only moderately recently, where every single time you enter a missing persons case, or even sometimes a John or Jane Doe case, the computer will just scour the records to see similarities to other cases. Now, this is for everything new, all the old, you know, pen and paper cases that are just in filing cabinets and places haven't been added. So when you're getting cases that are like 20, 30 years old like this, I mean, this is a really strong case for the importance of digitizing these old records as quickly as possible. But I mean, that's going to take a while. I don't know, like I've heard that there are other agencies across Canada that are now running their records through these new automated systems as quickly as possible, just in case. Because there's now, like, we're hearing through the grapevine, I don't want to read anything official because this is not on any news sites, no police yeah. reports, but like you and I are hearing from people that we know.
From our sources.
Yeah. From our sources that there's like people in Vancouver that are starting to get together and like
yeah.
all the gays are asking each other.
Montreal,
missing people? Montreal. I think I heard about...
Actually, Jake was telling
Winnipeg
me...
Winnipeg or Edmonton, one of the two, but I can't remember which one people are asking around now.
Jake was telling me actually that there is a growing concern in Vietnam. So in Ho Chi Minh and Hanoi, with the extremely high disappearance rate of gay men in those cities.
Mm.
So are they being disappeared by, you know, state functions? Are they coming out and eloping, or is there something more nefarious? There's yeah. a really high disappearance rate for gay men. And in cities and places where that's true, people are starting to think, is there a darker reason yeah. for that? So it's all very grim. We'll keep an eye on Montreal, Vancouver, Vietnam, and see if anything emerges out of there. Of course, we have told our listeners before, this is not the first gay serial killer. There was one in the States,
yeah.
there's been one in the UK, and one in Australia, all within the last 5 years,
yeah.
who have been caught, thankfully.
And many of them use the same tools. So, you know, if you're using the social apps,
yeah.
you know, do the usual. There are huge checklists of how to protect yourself.
So something else has come up, and it is a man who clearly, I think, needs a bit of a primer on community relations.
Okay.
And this man is Chief Mark Saunders of the Toronto Police Service. So you have a community barely recovering from knowing that there's been a man marauding around just wiping people out for over a decade. And there's a man doing that with little to no police prevention, you know, and it's you know, there's been organizations in Toronto crying for help for a long time. And there's been whispers in the gay community for a long time.
Yeah.
And the chief said this, and quoting off the Globe and Mail here, we knew something was up, dot, dot, dot. We did not have the evidence. And he goes on to say, if anyone knew before us, it's the people who knew him very well, very, very well. And so that did not come out. And, you know, he goes on to talk about how people simply didn't tell the police. So they can only act on the evidence they have. They never had enough evidence before to look into it. This has gone down like a lead balloon.
Yeah.
It's
one of those things where, like, I've spoken with a few people where they're like, they understand the push of like what was behind this comment, but it was just not phrased in a very constructive way. So to say something to the tune of like, you know, hey everyone, we're not psychic, we can't do anything until you tell us, as opposed to we clearly have a reporting problem, as in like we the police need to invest more in how community reporting goes down. Because when you say that, then it's now in the middle space that, you know, the police need to be more proactive about community reporting. They need to welcome the community more.
Yeah.
And the community does have its part to play, but the police have to clean up their side of the issue so that reporting, it's basically like, yeah, they can only do what they know about, but are they listening to what they're being told? And are they opening channels so that it's easy to tell them?
Now, me and you had a heated debate about this earlier, where for me, this really read as victim blaming. And the victims here are innocent, often marginalized, racially marginalized gay people in Toronto who thought, for some crazy reason, that, you know, the village in Toronto in Canada would be safe. That they wouldn't get murdered walking down the street in Toronto. And that's not true. And there was a failure of policing where a man could do these murders for a decade plus. And the community is, frankly, extremely annoyed at the police. And then to say, well, if you'd have told us sooner, we'd have acted on it, is so tone deaf. Decades of community organizations being like, hey guys, where all of our friends are going missing.
I'm not denying that this is a PR disaster. How they went about doing this is all sorts of wrong.
It's tone deaf. It's absolutely tone deaf.
But there is, and this is something that when we were talking earlier, you were like, yes, but I mean, the core of the issue is that there is this feedback cycle that, you know, the police aren't really listening, so the community don't trust the police, so they're not really reporting things, but the police can't do anything unless people report, so then they stop listening because no one's talking to them anyway.
There's a great example that I want to share with
you. Bounces back and forth and back and forth. But the thing is, the police are organized. They're an institute, whereas people are just people. Hundreds of thousands, in the case of Toronto, millions of people out there doing their own thing. The police are organized. The only way this is going to break is if they take responsibility, because they can, because they are organized. An institute can address itself more quickly than the masses. So, I mean, it's up to them. And a lot of this is animosity that goes back to the 50s and 60s. Like, this is like the fruit machine years, and they just never bothered to clean it up.
It's so much more than that. We were talking about, I think it was the 10-year anniversary of Operation Soap or something. It was a ridiculous date like that, where people were celebrating a major victory for gay rights. And then it emerged that the Toronto Police Service spent $1 million on an undercover sting operation.
I actually researched it this morning. I can tell you exactly what happened. 2016, the chief of police issued an official apology on behalf of the Metropolitan Toronto Police Service to the gay community for Operation Soap, which happened in 1981. And 7 days later, they did the exact same sting in Scarborough.
Yeah, and it was $1 million sting where they arrested like three people.
The police service, maybe they're not doing an excellent job of it. Maybe they are. It depends on the region we're talking about. But there are police services that are working very hard at undoing the negative community mm-hmm. interactions they had that date back to the 60s. And they're working hard to address this. And then this happens in Toronto.
And everybody looks bad.
Everybody looks bad.
There are methods that work with the community and earn that trust. And then going to the media and saying it's your fault that this murder walked around and not our fault because we did a perfect investigation is absolutely... I mean, I have run out of words.
Well, I think his comment was more to the tune of, you guys should have been louder. So, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, I am not denying that the Metropolitan Toronto Police screwed up. By no means am I saying that. But there was this cycle of just feedback cycle of the community not trusting the police, who don't listen to the community, so they don't trust the police anymore. And a lot of it is also not having that instinct to just go above their heads and just like write letters to their local representative and be like, hello, local MPP, all these people are missing and the police are doing jack squat. And again, like, this is not blaming anyone for not doing anything, but it's just like we need more self-educating on how to account for disappointing structures. Mm. How do you go over somebody's head? I only know this because part of my job now is working with the police, and they tell me all the time, if you're not happy, this is how you go over my head. And it's like, okay, but everyone needs to know this. This is not a me thing.
There's also, and this is the last comment on it, because we need to jump to the next subject. The onus for working with communities to get them to trust you
is the police. Yeah,
it's on the police.
Yeah, absolutely.
And although us as community, we need to take some responsibility for our own safety, that trust, that's on them to build. And I think after a long history of abusing that trust, I think there's some major work that needs to be done here. Anyways, let us know what you think on this situation. Tweet us at TalkCanQueer. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to play the new track from Janelle Monáe, featuring actually the actress who was in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, okay.
It's the new Guardians of the Galaxy movie. So this is the song Make Me Feel, and the video has a really cool bisexual kind of theme to it, which is nice.
Well,
and Janelle Monáe's sexuality is notoriously a closely guarded secret.
Well, she's an Afrofuturistic artist. So if you don't know about Afrofuturism, it's one of my favorite things. It would take me 20 minutes to explain it even. So
we don't have that time.
Just read an article. Parliament Funkadelic was also Afrofuturist. And the idea of like fluid or ambiguous sexuality is kind of baked into the genre. It's fantastic. I love it. None of this surprises
This is
me.
Janelle Monáe, Make Me Feel, ahead of a new album coming out soon. We did dip out on an F word, and we'll be back just after this.
Baby, don't make me spell it out for ya. All of the feelings that I got for ya can't be explained, but I can try for ya. Yeah, baby, don't make me spell it out for ya. You keep on asking me the same questions. Why? And second guessing all my intentions. Should know by the way I use my compression that you got the answers to my confessions. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
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 Uh-huh. So it's so good skin real. Uh-huh. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
You know I love it, so please don't stop it.
You got me right here in your jean pocket.
Right now.
Laying your body on a shag carpet. Ooh. You know I love it, so please don't stop it. It's like I'm sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better.
and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. I'm still Luke Smith.
I am also still Luke Smith.
Otherwise known as Sebastian.
Oh, wait, yeah.
Sebastian, how do you identify? Do you identify as a heterosexual, a gay woman, not a lesbian, a gay woman,
yeah,
a gay man, bisexual, or Danish?
There's another option.
Or opt out.
Or opt out, yeah. Opt-
so there was a... at underscore you had one job one is a Twitter account. There's a screen grab that's gone viral on Twitter of a what is your sexual orientation drop box for a job application. And
for job application, why?
Danish with a capital D. It's like from Denmark, Danish.
Yeah.
It's apparently its entirely own sexual orientation. I've met Nordic people. And sometimes I think maybe they do have their own sexual orientation. But I've never seen it in a job application, you know.
Well, it's the reputation that the North has is that a lot of people look at Norway as being these tall, beautiful, like Alex Skarsgård kind of people. But Norway thinks that Sweden has the most beautiful people. And then Sweden thinks that Denmark has the most beautiful people. And nobody, weirdly enough... Beautiful blondes. That's
so. Would you describe your sexuality as Danish? And maybe it's maybe this is a campaign by the Eurovision entry. Do you make love like a Scandinavian? We played the song.
Yes, recently. We did. I thought they were Norwegian, though.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Maybe they have a thing for Danish. Anyway, let us know, do you identify as a Danish sexual or your sexual orientation as Danish? Let us know.
Other than, like, there's more bikes than cars in Denmark. Like, is there much
They have great booties.
Oh, my God. Because they take the stairs.
You know what? My sexual orientation might be Danish.
Mine might be Belgian.
There's a safari park in the West Midlands. And it's the West Midlands Safari Park, weirdly enough, is the name of it. It's in Worcester in the UK.
Yeah.
And there are a number of lions at this park. Well... It is that time of the season.
Yes.
Where all of the lions are getting very friendly.
Very friendly.
With each other. They're making some best friends for life.
Yes. Some adult times.
Three of the male lions just... Maybe they were tired of waiting for the female lions. Maybe they just wanted to express their affection for each other. But these three lions engaging in certain activities raise lots of eyebrows. Apparently,
this is actually normal behavior for lions.
This is true.
It is.
Apparently, there was a half-term nursery group.
Fantastic.
Had to have their eyes averted and shuffled away from the naughty lions. And there's women complaining that they had to shield their children's eyes. And
yeah, maybe they were just interested in pirates.
Yeah, so there's a number of...
Or not pirates, buccaneers, because most of the buccaneers were gay. I don't know if you knew that. They had like a gay marriage kind of thing called matelotage. Anyway, yes,
I'm surprised. I mean, how do you have that conversation with your kids? Like you see animals doing animal things?
If they are young enough to not know that the male and female lions physically look different, then you don't have to do the conversation. You just be like, yeah, no lions. Great. Lions have manes. Fantastic. Only male lions have manes. Just leave that detail out. Just be like, no, they're... getting friendly, they're mummy and daddy lions, and just ignore the fact that they're two daddies, but that's okay.
Actually, there's a great line here where a woman who was talking about her three-year-old son to the Sun, the TV, she was saying that we stopped on the track through the lions area, and I'm quoting here, and told the kids to look at the daddy lion who was like 30 feet away, and everyone's like, oh, cool, daddy lion. And then it all kicked off with them mounting each other and getting very intimate and growly. Archie, the three-year-old, realized the daddies were up to something before we could quickly speed off.
So I guess they took my recommendation in advance and it just didn't work.
No. It reminds me of, I think it was Kenya or Uganda, one of the countries, that there was a similar incident in the safari and they blamed gay tourists.
Oh.
That was what was inspiring these lions to behave in such a manner.
I see.
So I have one last story and then we are going to jump to the queer episode on trans homelessness.
Okay.
Now, there was a number of stories you didn't get to this week. Bermuda, Kenya... Charmed will have a lesbian witch in the remake. No time for that today.
A remake already?
I know.
It's not even been that long.
So in Starkville, Mississippi...
Okay.
They applied, a group applied for a pride permit.
Okay.
Now, this town has approved every permit application for like 8 years.
Okay.
Not missed a beat.
Okay.
There was no issue with security, no issue with the finances, no issues.
Mm-hmm.
Complete, bog standard, we need the permit, no issues either side. They got told no.
Mm-hmm.
The council of aldermen were like, no. No reason given.
No reason.
Yeah, so they sued them.
Oh, how'd that turn out?
And they're suing them for violating their First Amendment, which is discrimination based on... So the Fourth Amendment is equal protection, and they're suing it as a clear breach of discrimination, which relates actually to a Supreme Court decision that came out this week in the States that found that discriminating on the grounds of sexual orientation is protected in the U.S. Under the grounds of sex. So they've read in sexual orientation at the U.S. Supreme Court level.
Okay.
For sex. So that's huge. It will afford major new protections to LGBT folks. They thought they'd get away with it, and then 2 weeks later they were like, no, we're not going to just take this lying down. So they sued them, which is the American way.
It is, yeah. So,
anyway, that's all we have time for today on our half of the show. We're going to play Rhea May's Red Light. There's a great new remix out. I'm a huge fan of Rhea May.
We met her once, didn't we?
No.
I thought we had.
No, not yet.
We've interviewed so many people.
I know. Although if you are listening, we are available for an interview. Rhea. So if you are interested, let us know. Aptalk and Queer, you can find us. So this is Rhea May's Red Light, the D&D remix. And after that, we will be joined by Stephanie, or rather Stephanie will join in herself with a show that we're putting in on this one, covering trans homelessness across Canada. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much for listening.
And it'll change your mind. Give me just one more night, more time. Sitting at a red light, practicing your goodbyes, getting your words just right for the last time. Who's gonna run through your head? Who's gonna lie in your bed? Are they gonna make you happy? Make you forget? Erase everything that we had. Take back every word that we said. Undo everything that we did. That we did, that we did.
Can't let you go. It's like a bad dream when you tell me you don't love me no more. Ain't enough streetlights in the city to find our way home. It's a bad dream, you don't want me, and I can't let you go. You don't love me no more.
Close to mine, trying to remember what it feels like, running out of patience, patience, trying to think of something that'll save us, you're holding it all in your hands, breaking my heart, cause I
can't let you go, it's like a bad dream when you tell me you don't love me no more, ain't enough streetlights in the city to find our way home, it's a bad dream, you don't want me. And I can't let you go. You don't love me no more.
Welcome to a special edition of Queer Radio. I'm Stephanie Tierney. This special episode is part of the Homelessness Marathon 2018. Today on the program, I'm joined by local transgender activist Gloria Halverson. Gloria is a person in St. John, New Brunswick, who has experienced homelessness, unemployment, and poverty because of her gender identity. LGBTQ2+ homelessness is a serious issue in Canada, And it is my hopes through interviewing Gloria that we can explore some of these struggles and learn. Please stay tuned for Queer Radio. So Gloria, thank you for joining me here on Queer Radio and for taking part in the Homelessness Marathon. This is the first time Queer Radio has been part of this marathon, and so I'm very excited to have some LGBTQ2+ voices in the mix. And we're going to be talking about poverty, we're going to be talking about homelessness, and we're going to be talking about struggles finding employment. And we're also going to be touching a little bit on queer and trans youth homelessness in Canada, which is a huge, huge problem. And I've done some research here for this program and discovered that there aren't many resources in our communities for these kids. So Gloria, speaking of that, I know you've helped out some youth who have experienced some discrimination and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that and what your involvement was with it?
I'd be happy to. Mostly it's parents reaching out. They'll show up or reach out to me by social media. And they're struggling. They're not sure what to do. They have a trans youth or someone that's questioning. They're not sure. They're at that stage where they're just not sure. There's a certain level of confusion. Often it's I'm brought into the equation by therapists, counselors, and they ask me to attend one of the sessions. Just to put a face and kind of a real-world thing to it, although there's many very well-meaning counselors around, not everybody has the experience behind what trans is and the issues that trans face, or LGBT, I'll say plus, I know there's a lot of letters, it's just out of their realm. And although they are growing, and we are fortunate enough to have some, this is something where they reach out to local organizations like UBU just to get some input. I don't show up as a counselor. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I run a peer support group, and I help people. Most of what I do is try to connect people with other people that can help them. And fortunately, with the community, communicating with itself, within itself, and helping itself, we do tend to build a bit of a database. I can send you to a psychiatrist that can help you, that is experienced in this, that knows what they're doing. Things like that, endocrinologist, or how do I get started with this? How do I get help? And I get the ball rolling for people. It's rather nice. They do send feedback back and such, and by and large, it's been pretty good. Mostly because through trial and error over the years, we know who to deal with and who to send people to. When it comes to the homeless thing, it's a whole different ballpark. A lot of agencies, although they can be geared towards helping people who are homeless, there's the equation of someone being in a homeless situation, being put in a shelter, and then running into issues within the shelter, a trans person that doesn't pass, and you have problems with other people in the shelter. And it happens. And it's people end up being removed from a shelter. That can happen. Or the person just doesn't go to the shelter. They're back on the street because they actually feel safer hiding somewhere all by themselves in a tent or somewhere than having to face.
That's so true. For instance, in St. John, I know that there is there's one shelter in the city for youth, and I've been told by somebody in my network of people that there is space for a trans person in this shelter, but that space is separate from the general population within the shelter, and that's terrifying. And as you've touched on a little bit about the shelters for adults, I'm being informed that there are sort of these loose rules for how trans people can fit into the mix, and that is they have to pass in their gender. So that is, if they're male to female, they have to pass as a female, and if they're female to male, they have to pass as a male. And that's alarming, to say the least. And these, in the case of trans women, they're being sent to the men's shelter where they're experiencing violence. And like you're saying, that probably a lot of these folks are just, they're safe, they feel safer just being in an alleyway somewhere as opposed to facing the discrimination from shelter staff and from their co-residents.
Absolutely. What happens is you're trying to avoid the direct confrontation,
yeah,
where you're actually having to interact with people as opposed to being homeless and alone, where you less have to, or you do have to, but there's that illusion of I'm alone, so I'm safe.
Yeah.
I felt it myself. I'm still homeless. I've been bouncing around from people. I've been fortunate. I've slept in my van. I slept in my car before that. I have never been to a shelter. I have the anxieties about turning to one.
Yeah.
Because of that, I'm trans. I don't pass. I'm okay with it, but not necessarily the rest of the world is.
Mm.
Most people are good, but there are those who, they're just not nice to people like me. Mm. So I generally myself, I just try to avoid the issue. Mm. I do know someone. I have to keep this. I can't break confidence.
Yeah.
But I do have someone who moved from another city to here because of issues they had where they were, seeking help. Just they needed a new start.
Mm-hmm.
They don't pass. They did go to a shelter. They had issues with other people in the shelter. It set them back rather than help them. And then they left the shelter and ended up homeless here. They've turned to prostitution. There's no recourse. They can't get a job to save their life. But they're eating, and they have a roof over their head now, and they're alone, on their own.
Yeah.
This is so sad a story, and it's too often repeated. And I wish I had a magic wand to fix this, but really the solution is beyond just the poverty issue, which we should discuss as well.
Yeah.
It's the issue about getting society to, by and large, accept trans people. You can legislate something and make something your rights, but then there's the real world, how people actually really interact with you.
Right. Sometimes it looks good on paper, but
exactly,
might not necessarily transfer
exactly
to regular life. So, Gloria, you just mentioned that you've experienced some homelessness, and I, from what I know of you, I assume that that's a direct byproduct of lack of employment, underemployment, or just employment period. Would you mind sharing some of your feelings about that and just your experiences?
Absolutely.
Whatever you're comfortable with.
Sure, sure. I can be transparent with this. Pardon that.
Mm.
I was homeless since May. I have been homeless of this year. It's been a struggle. The place I lived, I got so behind on my rent. Really, it was time to kick me out. I don't hold malice towards them.
Mm.
I had no means to pay. I had no work. I maxed my credit out. I used up all my resources. I had some help from family, but there's only so much you can do with that. And just basically everything ran out. The employment I had for a long time, one of my main jobs was, I was there 18 years, and I ended up with nothing. They didn't actually fire me. They cut my hours. It was before transgender was included in the Human Rights Code. I had no recourse, although I did explore that. Most of my belongings ended up on the street. The pickers took them all or just made a mess. I lived in my car. I couch surfed a bit as I could without invading someone too much. You can overstay a welcome as much as there is a welcome. And I bounced around a bit.
Do you feel like that homelessness was a direct result of discrimination in your search for employment?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big part of it. This area is definitely a depressed economy. Looking for work is a tough thing anyways.
Yeah.
And to have trans on top of that really compounds the issue of trying to find gainful employment. I'm well-educated. I've applied at numerous places. I don't get anything. Sometimes I know I'll get an interview after they read my resume and they like it. And then sometimes I know as soon as I walk in the door from the look of them, okay, I know I'm not getting anywhere, but I'm going to try to make a good impression.
You've told me this before, like you walk into that room and you can just feel that
tension,
that uncomfortable or like unpleasant sensation that comes that old, between.
What do we got here kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're a Gloria, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what it is. I really don't know what to do at this point. I have reached out to a couple of local centers, a women's outreach and such, and they're trying to find me a place. I have found employment. It's not much, but it's an all right job. Not top dollar. It's $12 an hour, but it's part time.
Hmm.
I make good hours sometimes, you know, 30 hours, and sometimes I make 12 or 14 hours.
Right.
It's the nature of the business. It's what it is. It's not about me or anything. They're very good with me, and I thank the world of them for being accepting and bringing me into their fold. But I'm used to having gainful employment. I'm used to helping other people, not being like this.
Yeah.
And it's a real, how do I say this? It's humbling. A wake-up call. It's like the cold water in your face. Okay, here's life slapping you.
Yeah.
I try to be resilient. I don't think of myself as a strong person, but I am someone who tries to be strong. I did end up at a call center. I won't name, actually. I was at two. I was at one. Their attrition rate was through the roof, so they go through people just like crazy.
Right.
But still, it was employment. I tried it. It was predominantly American customers from the southern U.S., and the transphobia was ridiculous. Angry people just at me. Sometimes I couldn't process the call. I take a call. Hi, this is Gloria. How can I help you? And I would hear, are you a man or a woman?
Hmm.
I said, I'm a woman. I do have a deeper voice, trying to pass by it. And I don't believe you. I want your supervisor. So I don't even get to do the call.
Right.
Right. I lasted about 6 weeks. And to be honest, it was at the point I had a pit in my stomach. I was trembling, fit going to work, just having to face another day of that.
Yeah.
And I ended up leaving. I don't know. I look back and I really needed that money, but do I really need to let myself psychologically go to the point of a wreck or drive myself to do another suicide attempt?
Yeah.
I ended up, everything went to crap. I'm homeless. I did end up at a call center this summer, another place with a high attrition rate, the same old story. It's I don't understand. I don't have a lot of call center experience, so I really can't comment on the industry per se. But it does seem to be that there's a few that go through people. And when you're trans, that's even tougher. My voice does not match my name. And I deal with it. I've been laughed at. I've had Gloria, ha ha, and just this big laughing tirade.
Right, right.
And stuff like that. And there's a point where you're just, it's hard to take it.
Yeah.
And you just can't do it. You're a mental wreck.
Yeah.
Just to be able to face it yet another day.
Mm.
That one, I did pretty good. I lasted almost 6 months and it was finally time to go. There are a couple of other issues with it, too. I had oncology appointments, and they wouldn't let me take time off for it.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, Gloria, when you were between jobs or when you were struggling, I'm assuming you went to employment insurance or social assistance to
yes,
seek
I
some
did.
Help. What was your experience being a trans person and interacting with some of those agencies?
Mixed. Okay. When I first really sought help with the transgender side of things, I went to my family doctor. She referred me to counseling, and I did end up hooked up with a psychologist and really was dismissed as just offhand, you're a cross-dresser or whatever, and literally waving hand. Mm. And I walked out of there feeling way worse than when I walked in.
Mm.
And I never reached out for any help for about 3 months. And I got to the point where I was going to crash. I need some help with this. I got to deal with this. I got to figure this out. So I reached out again, only this time. And this is advice I really want to push towards people.
Mm.
Make sure you ask that you get someone who is experienced with gender identity issues. Mm. Just don't throw me to someone. It has to be someone who can help. And I did it that time, and they did send me to someone. I'll say the name. It was Mac McKenzie, and he was great, and he was able to help me and get me connected to people. And then I ended up with a psychiatrist who is just amazing. She's experienced with transgender issues, is actually from the States and then came here. Incredible. And I actually got the help I needed.
Mm-hmm.
The mental help, the medical help. I was ended up getting hooked up with the right endocrinologist and able to transition safely.
Yeah.
Socially transition, it's a whole different ballpark. There's one thing about being comfortable in your body. It's another thing about having to deal with the public when people have an issue with you. And then you compound homelessness and lack of jobs on top of that. No wonder our suicide rate's through the roof. It's ridiculous. The last stat I seen was 43%. I haven't seen an updated stat, but maybe there is now.
Mm.
I'm hoping it's a little bit better with the Human Rights Code being changed. We'll see when new stats come out.
That's like we said a few minutes ago, though. Sometimes it looks good on paper.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to... gonna follow through. Now, I've read about the unfortunate part for this episode is that there's really not statistics or information available for queer and trans youth homelessness in the Maritimes that I could find anyway. But in Toronto, there has been some statistics captured. Because the reality is that I'm learning is that a lot of people who go into shelters because they're homeless, these shelters and organizations aren't actually capturing the information about these people. So, in fact, a lot of the shelter intake forms only have the male and female checkbox, mm-hmm. and that they're not even collecting information about people's sexuality or gender identity and expression. So that's troublesome to me.
It is troublesome and worrying and dangerous to people. There's another side of it, which I bring up. There's a side of, you could say the religious right, or you could just say the right mm-hmm. in general. Some of these places are run by people from that spectrum of society who are well-meaning, yet exclusionary to people who are trans or non-conforming. Or just their sexuality, their sexual preference. I hate the word preference, but
right.
For the sake of understanding. And they reject. It's not their cup of tea. It's crazy. I wish there was a solution. I think the number one thing, or not number one, I'm not going to do that, but there is something that does has to be addressed, is the poverty itself. In this city... we have some of the highest poverty rates. We have the highest child poverty rate in the country, which is appalling. Yet we see property values being assessed and doubled, like en masse. And that happened not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this recent spate of it is the second go of that, right? So these doubled property values are doubled again,
mm-hmm.
right? Tax assessments are through the roof. Why is there no control over that? Why is that not regulated? There should be free enterprise, but there should be a certain amount of regulation where you can't actually bleed a society to the point that you're killing it.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, trying to rent from an actual owner of a property is very, very difficult to do now. Everything seems to be a property manager. They've blossomed.
Right.
And I know I can name two for sure. I won't on the air.
Mm.
That they flip tenants and the rent goes up a bit, rent goes up a bit, rent goes up a bit. Next thing you know, this apartment that should be like $600 or $700 is $850 or $1,200.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. And you don't even know who your landlord is. You're dealing with a manager.
Yeah.
The last place I stayed, I never met the owner. I asked who it was. They refused to tell me. And all they would tell me is he's in Calgary.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I was told. I don't actually know that.
Right.
People upstairs had an all-included rent. I wanted the same. They wouldn't do it for me. They offered it after they kicked me out.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I think there is definitely, it's a well-known fact that trans people also experience discrimination when they're going to look for a place to live as well, which compounds the whole situation. So it's kind of, to me, it's very cyclical in nature. You've got unemployment, you've got the homelessness based on lack of income, then you've got the discrimination from potential landlords, and it just goes round and round and round.
It's a vicious circle. My landlord was not transphobic. I just want to be clear with that. That was not the issue. It was really about finances.
Yeah. But I mean,
and
that, but
they're
that
trying
is
to squeeze every possible penny out of that place as opposed to charge a fair price.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, that is something that a lot of trans people do experience, which is kind of like you're saying with going to a job interview, and when you come through the door, they're like, it's like, I'm sure this happens with folks who go to look for an apartment or a house, and then, you know, the person, the apartment manager, shows up and sees you and says, you know, which I've experienced a little bit. Luckily, I consider myself fairly fortunate in the sense that although it's been uncomfortable at times, I've had to basically come out to a potential landlord, much as I'm guessing you may have, or coming out to a potential employer, which is also really, really uncomfortable and unpleasant. And so I think there's like lots of factors here that are affecting homelessness amongst trans people. The other thing I just wanted to briefly touch on was senior, you know, trans and queer seniors as well, because we've heard some stories about how gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender and queer seniors have had to go back in the closet when they've been transitioned to a seniors care complex or a nursing home. And that's a tragedy too. And I wonder, I mean, I wish we had the statistics on that too. Like,
me too.
You know, I'm sure there are some homeless queer and trans seniors, and that's definitely a segment of the population that we don't know anything about.
Well, to be honest, that's a very real fear I have.
Yeah.
I am 3 years from getting my old age pension, and my health is not the best as it is. I've dealt with the ravages of cancer, and it's done what it's done to me.
Yeah.
For me to go into a home as trans and then not be prepared to deal with it, or to have to deal with other folks in it not prepared to deal with it and be trapped there and not be able to leave is terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely something that crosses my mind too as you get older, because it's just, there's just not any real support for those folks.
No.
And for us down those few short years. Believe it or not, our time has basically come to an end. Do you have any parting thoughts, or are you comfortable with what you've shared so far?
I'm comfortable with what I shared.
Do you see resolution for any of these things?
I'm hopeful for it.
Yeah.
I don't see it in front of us, but I'm hopeful. Yeah. Hopefully things can change. For the LGBTQ plus community, it's really about getting society there, which unfortunately does take time. And as far as the poverty, yes, we did cover these issues, but overall, the people who run things, that run our provincial government, that run our civic government and such, they've got to take some responsibility for this. You've got to start regulating and stepping in and not letting landlords and property owners and the real estate folks popping up prices and tax assessments beyond realism. It's just getting ridiculous. It's gotten to the point. What about the pensioner who retired, they're comfortable in the home, they've got themselves set up to the point where okay, I'm okay now, I'm good here till I die or have to be committed to a home or something to more care. And then their property values double, their taxes double, and they lose their home.
Mm-hmm.
How was that okay? It's not okay. Yeah. And something should be done. Not just someone pounding their fist on a table. We have leaders, we elect them, they get good money, they can get pensions for short times of service. Do this. Yeah. Represent us.
Yeah.
Help us with this. Mm-hmm. Take some responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, oh my gosh.
Yeah. No, and thank you for sharing that. And I can tell you're very passionate about it, as most of us are, because it directly impacts a lot of us. And so, Gloria, if somebody was out there listening and was struggling and was identifying as a member of the LGBTQ plus community, how's the best? Are you comfortable with them reaching out to you for support?
Oh, and, please do.
And how please how do. How should they do that? I know you've got an email address.
I have an email address. It's sound, S-O-U-N-D, at nbnet.nb.ca. Mm-hmm. There's the UBU Atlantic, which is an organization I am part of. We're a transgender support and advocacy group. We run peer support group meetings, the whole bit. They're all confidential. What happens there stays there. Mm-hmm. Attend, reach out to us, message us through the group, send me an email. There's also PFLAG, which is a LGBTQ plus support network, and it's Canada-wide, and we do have a chapter here in St. John. Reach out to them too. Mm-hmm. I'll say the name, I'm sure it's safe. Stu Kearney is a facilitator. He runs it, and it is on Facebook. You can reach it. You can find it on the internet. They do have actual URL web pages, and you can contact them, and you'll find yourself getting support from people who have the lived experience that can say, well, I went to this place and they helped me. I went to that place. It was a disaster. And you can get some guidance where to go and get some real help.
Great. Thank you again, Gloria, for coming in and having a chat with me. I appreciate
you
your time.
Having me, and, Stephanie. Always a pleasure.
I hope things look upwards for 2018 for you, and be well.
Thanks.